funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How ethical is the international adoption industry, and how often are American families looking for children overseas unwitting participants in the separation of children from parents who love and want them? More children were adopted into the U.S. from Guatemala in 2008 than from any other foreign country. And when investigative journalist and photographer Erin Siegel first set out to cover this phenomenon, she imagined a sort of feel-good photo essay about the happy coalescence of these new families. But after an extensive international probe, she discovered that for at least some of them, a far darker reality of stolen children and profit-driven transactions lies just beneath the surface. She shares her findings in the new book, Finding Fernanda, Two Mothers, One Child, and a Cross-Border Search for Truth. Erin, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Tell us a little bit more about how you discovered this story and what made you realize there might be more to it than you had initially expected.
Sure, Chris. I actually got onto the topic sort of by accident. My sister Amanda and I had traveled to Guatemala on vacation, completely unrelated to work. And as we were leaving the Guatemala City airport, this was December 2007 when the adoption industry was sort of at its height, we were on a flight leaving Guatemala with around a dozen adoptive parents. And so just the visual image of all of these new families, the new children, the parents, it was really compelling to me as a visual reporter, as a photographer. And so when I got back to the States, I started to do a little research to figure out, okay, well, you know, is there anything new to this story? Can I go back and photograph an adoption-related story? It seemed like a great idea, except as I started reading through the different news clips, I was reading about stuff that wasn't so happy and wasn't so good, clips about alleged kidnappings, about child trafficking, these kinds of issues. And so, you know, looking at the dates on these news clips, it spanned a decade. And so that brought the question to mind, why would such abuses be able to occur for so long? And so from there, I began doing some general research and came across the story of a woman named Betsy Emmanuel from Tennessee, who went on to become the American main character of my book. And Betsy's story was incredibly compelling, and so that's what really drove me to do a book. It was such a complicated and important story.
So Betsy herself is the mother of eight children, five of whom were adopted from overseas. And she was interested in adopting. She worked with Christian organizations mostly to find her children.
That's correct. Right.
And she said at first, you know, I've had lots of great experiences, but one that really didn't turn out well.
Exactly. And as soon as I heard that, it made me even more interested because Betsy sort of was old hat at adoption. She had done it before. She had adopted three special needs kids from Asia, sort of had gone through the process, bumps and all, and she seemed like someone who knew how things worked. And so for her to say, this Guatemalan adoption really shook me, I was very interested in hearing what had happened.
So she was in the habit of browsing these websites that list pictures of kids available for adoption. And there's one in particular, and forgive me because the name escapes me now, but they are still in operation.
Yeah, precious.org is the website where she initially saw a Guatemalan girl she tried to adopt.
I have to say, I went online to that site, and on the one hand, it's very moving to see the stories of all these children. On the other hand, it feels very much like a catalog.
You know, people have said that. You know, it does serve a purpose to find kids' homes. The other part of it is, though, there's not a lot of backstory as to how those children became available for adoption or, you know, their personal history.
Mm-hmm. So Betsy fell in love with a little Guatemalan girl called Jennifer on this site and had believed that the process to adopt her was underway.
Correct. Yeah, she saw a photo of Jennifer. Jennifer was an older child. She was nine. And for Betsy's family, they were looking for an older child. As you said, they had kids already. They felt an older girl would be perfect for their family. And so when Betsy saw Jennifer's picture, she thought, okay, Guatemala, it's relatively close. The process seems pretty simple. It seemed like the perfect situation. And so she did start the process to adopt Jennifer.
What had she been told about what Jennifer's story was and why she was available for adoption?
Well, Betsy says she was told that Jennifer had become an orphan because her mother had HIV, her mother was a prostitute, and had simply wasn't able to care for Jennifer anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so Betsy was told the little girl had just been relinquished. She was struggling with the separation from her mother. Her mother was around, but, you know, no longer in her life at this point. And when Betsy signed up to adopt Jen, it was a very, very new situation. The child had been separated for, I think, mere weeks.
Hmm. So she was expecting that she would meet a child who perhaps had some adjustment issues, but she did not imagine that there were any entanglements with regard to her availability.
Right. She thought it was a fairly cut and dry case. Betsy said she was under the impression that Jennifer's mother was actually dying, mm-hmm. which was why she had offered her daughter in adoption.
She had also been told that Jennifer had a sister named Dulce who had already been adopted by a U.S. family. What happened when she tried to contact that girl's adoptive mother?
Well, Betsy says that Dulce's adoptive mother was a bit reticent to talk about Dulce's adoption, and Betsy had approached her with the idea that, okay, once Jennifer arrives in the United States, it would be great if she could, you know, hook back up with her little sister to have the girls reunite. And so the other adoptive mother felt like that wasn't a good idea. And so that was one of the first things that kind of gave Betsy pause and made her think about, well, why is that? She started feeling a little bit uncomfortable.
And this other woman said she doesn't even remember this sister of hers, but Dulce was, what, 5 or 6 years old. She should have been able to remember.
It would seem that way, yeah. Mm-hmm. She had said that Dulce had no recollection of a sister and had never mentioned Jennifer, whereas Betsy had been told that Jennifer really missed her little sister and actively always asked questions about her and wanted to make sure she was okay.
Okay, Erin, let's step back here for a minute. What sort of history has Guatemala had with placing its children for overseas adoption?
Well, Guatemala, you know, the adoption industry got its start sort of as the civil war in Guatemala was winding down. So the war officially ended in 1996. Adoptions had been ongoing since the late 80s, kind of during the onset of the war, during the peak of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And so through the 90s, the industry grew. It was highly profitable for the lawyers involved. It was a private industry, meaning the government didn't kind of play a big role in adoptions. And so year after year through the 90s, it sort of grew and grew until it reached its peak in 2007, 2008.
And during the years preceding that time, other countries, including developing countries, began tightening controls of overseas adoptions. Meanwhile, Guatemala maintained this reputation for remaining a kind of quick and easy place for prospective U.S. parents to find babies, to finalize adoptions. It could happen in some cases within a matter of 3 or 4 months.
Yeah, 4 months was sort of the quickest time frame for most adoptions through kind of the 2000s. But it was also a very attractive place to adopt from because children in Guatemala, because of this private system, were cared for in people's homes. The foster care system was sort of upheld as a gold standard. You know, one child in an adoption process would live with a family and theoretically receive care similar to that family's own children.
Mm-hmm. And that was one thing that prospective parents included in their fees would be some of the money to compensate the families that had cared for these children in their homes.
Oftentimes, yes.
Mm-hmm. What do we know about how the amount to which they were remunerated compared with what American parents were paying for this service?
Well, you know, it's funny. It's hard to evaluate because in the Guatemalan adoption system, there were a lot of different moving parts, I guess. Every adoption was different. And so, you know, an individual American adoption agency would generally work with a couple different adoption lawyers or facilitators, kind of contacts. And so those adoption lawyers or facilitators, in turn, worked with their own people, including foster mothers, other contacts, people known as jaladoras or baby finders. So it was a very kind of extensive system of different networks.
Mm-hmm.
And to kind of evaluate who was paid how much, you'd have to look at one specific network. A lot of times foster mothers, or at least the foster mothers I spoke to, said they were paid anywhere from $50 a month to around $200 a month.
And the cost of living is lower there. We should at least throw that in there. So that might be considered an appropriate amount of money in some cases.
Certainly.
Okay. What does it take legally for a child in Guatemala to be considered available for adoption outside the country?
Well, that means two different things. In Guatemala, to the Guatemalan government, an adoptable orphan would have to have relinquishment documents that were notarized and signed by witnesses. And the child's adoption paperwork went through a pretty long process through the Procuraduría General de la Nación, which is the PGN, the Solicitor General's office. Mm-hmm. It would be reviewed by investigators to make sure all the paperwork was in place and stamped with approval. On the American side of things, the U.S. Embassy in Guatemala City would review that file to determine whether or not the child in question would qualify for a U.S. immigrant visa as an orphan. And for that to happen, there were a couple different qualifications. The primary one was that either both or one parent had to be out of the equation for this child, and if there was a remaining parent alive, they could not be married.
Hmm. So a lot of that sounds like due diligence when we hear it listed that way, but you found evidence that parents who didn't necessarily know what they were signing were brought into these offices and compelled on occasion to sign these relinquishment documents.
Yeah, that's correct, and that's something the U.S. Embassy knew about as well. During the course of my research, I filed numerous public records requests with the federal government here in the United States, and as a result of those requests, they took about 2.5 years to get records back. I received over 2,000 pages of documents from the U.S. Embassy in Guatemala, which sort of spell out their concerns about fraud over the past 20 years in adoption. And so they show what the embassy was concerned about, and one of those issues were that birth mothers were compelled, either financially or through threats at times, to relinquish children.
So how often would U.S. officials step in to prevent the immigration of an adopted child to the U.S.?
You know, that's again, really hard to ascertain. Mm-hmm. According to these embassy documents, they found fraud through the early 2000s or signs of fraud in between 7 and 10% of all cases, and those are only the cases they were able to investigate. Given that they did speak of a lack of resources and a lack of staffers, that number was probably higher, but it's really difficult to ascertain exactly how much higher.
What's really heartbreaking about these stories is that you can have parents on both sides who mean well, and then these intermediaries are the ones who are committing these frauds, and neither side really knows what the truth is.
That's correct, and adoption fraud victimizes not only kind of children involved in bad cases, but the adoptive families and the birth families as well. I felt like a lack of information is what really kind of allowed such corruption to exist. And I felt like my main motivation for writing this book was to show and give a multidimensional perspective on one complicated case kind of from both sides.
Yeah, and in fact, we're going to take a quick break here in a moment, so we'll talk about the other side of the child in question, Fernanda, who is your title character. But I will say at this point, she was when the adoption of Jennifer fell through for Betsy, she learned about Fernanda and considered adopting her.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. She found Fernanda actually on the internet once again, and fell in love with this child's picture and felt compelled to adopt her.
My guest is investigative journalist and photographer Erin Siegel. We're talking this hour about her new book, Finding Fernanda, Two Mothers, One Child, and a Cross-Border Search for Truth. We'll continue this conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can get on the phone lines at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with investigative journalist and photographer Aaron Siegel, author of the new book Finding Fernanda, Two Mothers, One Child, and a Cross-Border Search for Truth. You can be part of the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. When we left off, we had Betsy Emanuel and her husband interested now in adopting this little girl who was just a toddler named Fernanda. But Fernanda, back in Guatemala, had a mother who very much loved her. Can you tell us about Mildred and what her life had been like in the months and years before Fernanda was taken?
Sure. Mildred was a single woman, or is a single woman. She lived on the outskirts of Guatemala City in a slum called Villanueva. And she had fallen upon some pretty hard times. She had recently split up with her common-law husband. They had three children together. And so Mildred found herself in a place where she had lost her job. She had lost her husband. Her and her sister were living together, and they were pretty much broke. They went through their savings. They'd been moving from apartment to apartment to try to get by. And Mildred was approached by a woman claiming to be a Good Samaritan who had heard about her just in the neighborhood. And this woman, Sabrina, offered her free rent. She offered her a free room to live in with her kids, and Mildred took her up on that offer, thinking that everything was sort of in good faith.
And we should say Mildred was visibly pregnant at this point.
She was, yes. She was.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so she meets this woman, and it sounds like the answer to her prayers. How did life work out with Sabrina and her partner as Mildred and her sister and the children were living there?
You know, at first, everything seemed okay. Mildred and her family moved in. They were very surprised at the actual state of the home once they got there. It was a mess. It was very dirty. Mildred's very poor, but she's very proud, and she's the kind of person that was raised kind of with the mindset that, you know, you keep your house spotless. And mm-hmm. So she set about cleaning, sort of helping Sabrina with laundry, basically working as a live-in maid as time went by. And after the first month, Sabrina started hinting to Mildred that she had a friend from church, a woman named Connie, who was an older woman who had never had her own children and had always dreamed of having children. And Sabrina started bringing up the idea that she felt that Mildred should maybe allow her youngest daughter, Fernanda, who was about two at the time, to stay with Connie as a kind of temporary full-time daycare situation.
Mm-hmm.
And that by giving Fernanda to Connie for a little while, that was sort of paying the favor forward.
Yeah, so it was doing a nice thing for someone else. And Mildred was resistant to this, but in some ways felt she couldn't refuse.
That's right. In the beginning, Mildred felt kind of a gut negative reaction. Something about the situation didn't make her feel right. Yet she felt so indebted to Sabrina that eventually she felt like, okay, well, this, even though I don't like this, this is the right thing to do, and I should just listen to Sabrina.
And it was never suggested to Mildred that she wouldn't have access whenever she wanted it to her daughter, or that she would lose control over the way her daughter was being raised.
That's right. Mildred says she was told that Connie would allow her to visit now and then. She would be able to speak with Fernanda on the phone if she wanted. She really did feel like it was just daycare until after she gave birth to the child she was carrying.
So let's talk about what happened there. She goes to the hospital and essentially is unconscious when this new daughter, Ana Cristina, is born.
That's correct. She was brought by Sabrina, she says, by Sabrina and Sabrina's partner to a private medical clinic where she does receive a couple injections and has a C-section. Mildred says it was never consensual. When she came to a day later, she was no longer pregnant and she had no idea where the infant was.
What did they tell her?
They told her at first they told her nothing. They said, oh, the doctor has ordered that this child can't be with you right now. Just relax.
Mm-hmm.
Mildred kept asking, well, where's my daughter? I want to see my daughter. And that's when she was told that the child was sick, there was something wrong with one of her lungs, and that Connie, the woman who was caring for Fernanda, had offered to provide the money for the medical services that this new child needed.
And there was talk of special tests that needed to be taken, which would require the new baby, again, being kept away from her mother.
Correct, yeah.
Was there anything wrong with Ana Cristina?
Not that I know of. That's actually a good question, but it seems like that it was just what Mildred was told to keep her from suspecting any wrongdoing at that point.
So what happened as time went by? Now we have Mildred without two of her children. What attempts did she make to get them back?
Well, after the C-section, she went back to Sabrina's house, and that's when everything sort of hit her. She had this realization that, you know, they're playing me for a fool. Both of my children are gone. Sabrina would not help her and actually stopped coming home. And so at that point, Mildred took her two remaining children and her sister, and they moved out. And she began filing complaints with local authorities. She went to the police, the police detectives, and she began actively trying to get her children back.
How much education does Mildred have?
Mildred went to elementary school until the fourth grade, mm-hmm. when her father pulled all of his kids out. So not much.
So she's semi-literate, but really can't. I mean, it would not be difficult. It would not be easy for her to find resources to step in and make a legal case here.
That's correct. And also in Guatemala, I mean, Mildred is sort of on the bottom rung of the social ladder. And so for her going to these government authorities, she speaks very quietly. She's painfully shy. She had a hard time speaking up for herself to neighbors, let alone authorities.
Mm-hmm. There was this issue of a DNA test that that Mildred was told she had to submit. Can you talk about that?
Sure. About a month after the C-section, Connie and Sabrina got in touch with Mildred, she says, and told her that, you know, the baby, Ana Cristina, her life is in danger, and we need to know whether or not it's a hereditary blood disease. They told Mildred that she had to show up at this DNA testing facility, but they didn't tell her it was a DNA testing facility. And so Mildred believed that by showing up, there might be a chance to save Ana Cristina's life.
Mm-hmm.
And so she did show up and gave her DNA.
Why, in fact, would that DNA have been necessary for the people who were? And we should say at this point, the suspicion is that these two children are being taken to be, for lack of a better word, sold for adoption overseas.
That's correct. But still, at this time, Mildred wasn't fully clear about that. She mm-hmm. wasn't sure why these women had her children, why they wanted to keep her children away from her. It was a very kind of distressing and completely confusing situation to her. She told me that she didn't have a clue as to how the adoption industry had worked and that it even was a big industry at that time. And so by giving a DNA sample, that test was then later provided to the U.S. Embassy as proof that the mother of Ana Cristina was on board with the adoption and had given her consent to relinquish this child.
Hmm. And there was no way for Mildred to know this at the time.
No, I don't think so.
So how did Betsy Emanuel find out that the adoptions, in now two cases that she had put in motion, were not legal and not ethical?
Well, Betsy was told by her adoption agency, Celebrate Children International, that, you know, just as had happened to Jennifer, Fernanda was no longer available for adoption. And she was told that just a couple months after she signed up to adopt Fernanda. And so when that happened a second time, Betsy says she was told that men with guns had showed up to reclaim Fernanda, that Fernanda's birth mother had decided to back out of the adoption. And just the fact that there was this alleged violence really made Betsy start to question, well, why would that happen? How did that come to pass? And why would my adoption agency be dealing with people that were involved with possible criminal wrongdoing? Mm-hmm. It really kind of made her start worrying.
And in fact, the opposite was true. When Mildred made efforts to get her daughters back, she received death threats.
That's correct. Mildred began receiving threats soon after she filed her very first complaint, and the threats continued sort of throughout the process.
So the girls ultimately end up in this city nursery in Guatemala. Can you talk about the kind of facility that was and what went on there?
Sure. Well, both of Mildred's children were sort of missing and at large for about 20 months, and they ultimately turned up in a Guatemala City orphanage, a place called Hogar Luz de María, which was a private nursery. It was a facility that worked with a couple of different American adoption agencies. They were established in 2004, and, you know, their story is that the children were simply dropped off there. There are a lot of questions as to how exactly that came to pass.
In other words, they say the girls were abandoned.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there were pictures taken of them that would appear to show that they had been there for some time, that they were not wanted by anyone. But it turns out, if you look really closely at the digital information that's attached to these pictures, it was multiple pictures taken on the same day in different outfits.
Yeah, that's correct. Actually, those images were from when Fernanda and possibly Ana, I think they were kept apart for a lot of the time, were in someone's private home somewhere in Guatemala, and I don't know where.
Mm-hmm.
Tracking where the children were kind of throughout these 20 months is a very difficult thing.
And in the city nursery, there were a lot of malnourished children as well.
Not in Hogar Luz de María. The children kept there were generally well-fed and, mm-hmm. and fairly healthy. But the fact is that these children weren't there for very long. They were there for the last couple months.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, other places that they had been sometimes were not great situations.
That's what it seemed like, correct. When they arrived there, they were in a fairly poor state of health.
How did Mildred find legal help to get her daughters back?
Mildred had seen a clip on TV which focused on other mothers who had lost children to adoption. And so she saw this clip and realized who was helping these women. It was an organization called Fundación Sobrevivientes, the Survivors Foundation, which is a nonprofit in Guatemala City that helps female victims of domestic abuse and violence. And so she approached the foundation for help after learning that they had been helping women whose children had been taken.
Mm-hmm. And there were, tell some of these stories, as heartbreaking as they are, I think it's important to get to these. There have been stories of mothers who've given birth and been told their babies died, and in fact that was a bald-faced lie.
That's correct, and that's been kind of reported in various reports over the years. There are many different ways in which women were separated from their children, and so that was one of them. Kind of poor indigenous women from the countryside often came to Guatemala City to find work, to work as maids, as caretakers. And so if they did have young children or if they were pregnant at the time, sometimes their employers were sort of involved in that separating. A number of different things could happen.
Do we know, Erin, how many children we're talking about that might have been adopted unwittingly by families thinking they were available, that in fact had parents who cared about them?
That number, again, there's no hard data to back that up. There are different reports that mention these cases, and the latest and kind of the most credible number is from the Commission Against the International Commission Against Impunity in Guatemala, known as CICIG. What CICIG did between 2008 and 2010 was take a look at all the adoptions that they're called transition adoptions, post-Hague adoptions that happened, and they looked at each case and sort of analyzed what went into each and every single one. CICIG's number was that 60% of those cases contained irregularities, yet that number also is problematic because irregularities can refer to anything from a missing document, errors on documents, to things like alleged kidnapping.
And UNICEF calls this nothing less than child trafficking. Is that right?
That's correct.
What kind of international law is available to prevent this?
You know, that's a very tricky question, and that's part of the problem. Here in the United States, we have ratified the Hague Convention on International Adoption, and that provides kind of a guideline for good practices in adoption. Yet the kind of weakness and the biggest failure of the Hague is that it only applies to other Hague countries. So today, non-Hague countries like Ethiopia, those safeguards don't apply.
If it's not already apparent, talk about what the motivation would be for anyone to do this to families, to take children away from parents who care about them, to give children to parents who want them but don't recognize that they already have homes.
It was profit, pure and simple. It, mm-hmm. it kind of goes back to the old saying that money corrupts. In Guatemala, finding and offering children in adoption was highly profitable for those involved in the industry.
And again, I suppose these children were appealing to American prospective adoptive parents because they could be made available so quickly. They didn't have to wait years on end.
Well, certainly. And in most cases, American parents were told very heartbreaking backstories as to each child's availability. They were told commonly that, you know, many orphans were the children of prostitutes. many children were malnourished and starving, and the parents generally couldn't care for them. I mean, they were given reasons that made sense.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Nancy on the line in Dallas. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. My comment, I'm a sociologist, and I noticed a lot of problems with each country as far as cultural wars and human rights violations that generate human rights violations and abused ethnics and oppressed women and create orphans. There's three major international guidelines. The 1928 Kellogg-Briand Treaty that was signed in Paris by 65 nations to outlaw war, and then the 1948-49 Geneva Conventions, which outlaws human rights violations, and then the creation of the International Crime Court in 2001 that would enable any person in any country to go through international legal avenues to hold that country accountable to the two previous international agreed-on treaties.
So, Aaron, are these statutes that Nancy alluded to, are they still in play in a lot of these international adoption cases?
They are, but they're not necessarily applicable. I mean, it's more immigration law that kind of regulates adoption, which is part of the failings of the system. I mean, when something like alleged kidnappings occur, I mean, immigration law doesn't really cover that.
Mm-hmm. Erin Siegel is my guest. She's an investigative journalist and photographer and author of the new book Finding Fernanda, Two Mothers, One Child, and a Cross-Border Search for Truth. We will talk more about this after the break. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is investigative journalist and photographer Erin Siegel, author of the new book Finding Fernanda, Two Mothers, One Child, and a Cross-Border Search for Truth. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Erin, what did it finally take for Mildred to be reunited with her children?
Actually, was an incredible stroke of luck, and one of the reasons that I was driven to write this book was the incredible, incredible story of how Mildred did get her kids back. It was with the help of Betsy Emanuel, the Tennessee adoptive mother. Betsy, with her suspicions about what had gone wrong in this adoption process, had sort of taken it upon herself to be an amateur detective of sorts, and so Betsy had started Googling on the internet, looking for clues as to what had happened to Fernanda. And she, through Googling, she was able to find a clip from the Guatemalan news media that mentioned Mildred Alvarado by name and mentioned her search to find her daughters. And so, you know, Betsy found this news article from her bedroom in Tennessee and had this moment of realization that, wait a minute, the child described as kidnapped in this news article is the exact same child that I've been trying to adopt. And so that sort of set in motion the events that led to Mildred's reunion with her daughters.
We should say, by the way, that when Betsy began speaking out about this concern she had, there were lots of prospective adoptive parents who were very angry with her for doing this.
There were. Kind of within the Christian adoption community, which Betsy was a part of, There were a lot of concerns because the facilitator in Fernanda's case, a Guatemalan man named Marvin Brand, had also facilitated the adoption of other children for other clients. And mm-hmm. so those adoptive parents were very concerned about, well, you know, with Betsy speaking out, are our own children's adoptions going to be at risk?
Yeah. So Mildred got her daughters back, but it was not an easy road. Ana Cristina, in particular, didn't remember who this woman was and was frightened of her.
That's correct. Ana Cristina suffered some severe trauma, and even to this day, she is developmentally slow and is still recovering as well. Fernanda is as well, but Ana had never met her mother. Mildred had never met this child until she was over 2 years old. And so, yeah, it's been a very slow recovery process.
Are Betsy and Mildred still in contact with one another?
They're not today. They know, I sort of have been keeping them in touch,
uh-huh.
but they're not directly in contact. Betsy doesn't speak any Spanish, and Mildred speaks no English, so it's a bit tricky for them to communicate.
So what effort did Betsy go to bring the agency to justice, the one in the United States and also the arm that was orchestrating things from Guatemala?
Well, after Betsy learned that a Guatemalan judge had re-given Mildred custody of her children once again, that's when she really felt compelled to act because she felt like she had something hard to stand on. And so she filed complaints with the Florida Department of Children and Families. The adoption agency she had used was based in Florida, so that was their licensing official. She filed complaints with the U.S. State Department, the Council on Accreditation. She spoke to a couple members of the media. Betsy tried to get help pretty much from anywhere possible, and not much was done. The Department of Children and Families in Florida did undergo, they performed an investigation into the case, except the fact that all of these alleged crimes happened in Guatemala really hampered their investigation. They
mm-hmm.
didn't have the resources to send someone to Guatemala. They barely had the resources to make phone calls and send emails to Guatemala and have translation happen. So it was a really difficult thing. And at the end of the day, they found that no hard data spoke to any criminal wrongdoing on the part of the adoption agency.
It's really disheartening to think about. In some ways, it's the perfect crime.
It is. It is. It's, you know, cross-border prosecutions and investigations present a host of challenges in any case. And when it's something like adoption, where you have many allegations, the American side of things, the adoptive parents might not have true verifiable data on the Guatemalan side of things. Guatemalan prosecutors don't necessarily have access to American records or government sources. It can be a real difficult thing to investigate.
So this is obviously not the most important thing here, but, you know, a lot of these prospective adoptive parents are out a lot of money if these things fall through. Is there not a way to prosecute on those grounds?
You know, it's been tricky. One thing that's been happening in the past couple of years is that there have been suits filed that are RICO suits, which is the Racketeer Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act.
Mm-hmm.
There have been civil suits, and there's been one criminal suit filed against adoption agencies. The first criminal suit was Heinrich versus Waiting Angels. And in that case, on the civil side of things, a federal judge found that the adoption agency wasn't the proper defendant. But the criminal case was successfully prosecuted, and the Waiting Angels folks did receive a sentence.
So in most cases, I would imagine we can assume that people who want to adopt children themselves don't recognize that they are dealing with corrupt agencies. What about the U.S. the U.S. arms of these organizations? Do they know?
That's a really good question, and it's hard to prove it either way if they know or if they don't know. I know in the investigation into the Emmanuel case that was done by DCF, they asked Sue Hedberg, who is the director of Celebrate Children, how well she knew her Guatemalan contacts and facilitators. And Sue and CCI presented DCF with a kind of list of each facilitator and Sue's level of knowledge with them. And in each case, she said she knew her contacts very, very well and that she had met them on numerous occasions. Sue speaks Spanish, so she said she knew them well. Yet at the same time, if that was really true, would she be working with someone like Marvin Brand, who has been implicated not only in the Emmanuel Alvarado kidnapping case, but in other criminal cases of wrongdoing as well? Brand currently is facing human trafficking charges in Guatemala, and he's a fugitive.
What do we know about how many children are still missing from Guatemala?
That, again, is a number that's very hard to determine. There are three very sort of more high-profile cases that are sort of making their way through the criminal justice system in Guatemala at the moment. There's the case of Loira Rodriguez, there's the case of Olga Lopez, and the case of Raquel Parr. And these women all know Mildred. They sort of were searching together at one point. And they've been searching for children for the past 5 years.
Hmm. Is there an outcry from within Guatemala now saying we have to stop, at least until we can make sure that everything is on the level, we have to stop allowing our children to be taken from the country?
That's exactly what has happened. Guatemala put a freeze on all new adoption processes on December 31st, 2007. And since then, there were thousands of cases sort of caught in limbo when that new ruling came into effect. And today, there are hundreds of those cases that remain in process that still haven't been resolved. It's always been a question when Guatemala will reopen their adoption system. There are estimates that range from, you know, in 6 months to in 6 years. Nobody really knows.
And you know, once again, as I'm sure you're aware, the tragedy there is that surely there are some children who are fully available for adoption that can't find homes because so many people have committed these heinous crimes.
Certainly, and that really was why I wanted to write this book, Finding Fernanda, because no one has given the public, either in Guatemala or in the United States, a full multidimensional picture of how such wrongdoing occurs. And it's like, without understanding that, how can ethical adoptions move forward, and how can a new system be enacted and put in place?
Is there anything that parents can do in order to know that they're dealing with a legitimate agency? And in fact, that, you know, sometimes you can buy a sweater from a legitimate store and not realize that it was made in a factory where the workers are abused. So is there a way to trace back to its origins the validity of whatever group you're dealing with?
There are different ways to sort of do your homework and background research on adoption agencies. There are a number of adoption listservs on the web, Yahoo lists, dedicated to research. There's one called the Adoption Agency Review List, in which potential adoptive parents can log on. You know, it's free, it's Yahoo. And they can ask questions like, hey, I'm thinking about using this agency and this agency. I would appreciate feedback. And then they'll receive feedback from folks off the list giving experiences. There are also review websites. Another thing adoptive parents can do is contact their local Better Business Bureau to check if there are complaints on file. And they can also talk to the state licensing agent for whatever agency they're thinking about. For example, the Florida Department of Children and Families. All of their records are publicly accessible. So if you ask for records related to a particular agency, they'll be able to tell you whether or not there's a complaint history, whether or not there have been investigations, and the content and substance of those investigations.
And that's important because, for example, CCI, which is the organization we've been talking about, is in fact still open for business and operating, but at least understanding that there had been complaints would allow people to make decisions for themselves.
That's correct. There have been numerous complaints, and at the last time I checked, there were 5 different investigations that the state of Florida did into CCI. Yet they'd never found any criminal wrongdoing or anything that would jeopardize CCI's operating license. Yet those kinds of information, those documents, could be really helpful for adoptive parents just to look at to see what the history of the agency actually is.
I want to read this email here that comes from a listener. As an adoptive mother of a boy from Kazakhstan, I realize some people are uncomfortable with the posting of children's pictures online. However, it was the picture on precious.org that moved us from thinking about adoption to following through, and it was one of the best decisions of our lives. And I do appreciate that perspective, so thanks so much for writing in. Did you find U.S. parents are more, you know, as you were talking to people about this story, are people concerned now about international adoption, which for a time seemed perhaps simpler than adopting domestically for some families?
You know, I spoke to many, many adoptive parents through the course of my reporting, and there are a lot of different perspectives. But yes, I spoke to many adoptive parents who did have questions and concerns about their children's adoption processes, yet trying to understand if there was any real fraud is really difficult. There are many adoptive parents, at least talking about Guatemala specifically, that have gone and hired searchers. That's a very popular thing today in Guatemala. You can hire pretty much, it's like a private investigator / searcher to go and find a birth parent to kind of trace the documents backwards to see what the child's real story is. So that's a possibility.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Tressa on the line in Dallas. Hello, Tressa.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Two separate couples and friends that have gone through an adoption agency, a pretty well-known here in Dallas. And when they were confronted about their past history with some fraudulent adoption, I call it child brokering, it's terrible. Both couples were well into the private adoption process, had paid fair amounts of money, and the adoption agencies dropped them. They gave them a bunch of excuses, but through a series of emails and basically, let them go, broke up with them. Is there anything, any sort of legislation or anything that, that people can use or confront the agencies with that, people should be able to know the history of the agency and not risk being dropped by them?
What do you know about that, Erin?
Well, a lot of it comes down to the actual contract that adoptive parents sign with their agency and what the language is in that contract. If the agency drops them and for no valid reason, I would think that you would be able to sue. I know in the case of CCI, there is an ongoing lawsuit regarding kind of medical issues of one family's adopted child. They were told that they were going to adopt a healthy child, only to find out that the child did have some severe medical needs that they were never informed about. And so I'm not sure what's going to happen with that suit, but it is ongoing. And so for adoptive parents that have been dropped or have challenges like the one the caller just described, it really kind of comes down to what the contract says.
Did you find any evidence, Erin, that women in Guatemala or elsewhere are being encouraged to have babies specifically to put them up for adoption?
Yeah, that's been noted in multiple reports over the years. The financial incentive was pretty high. I mean, the chance to make money in a simple, quick way was there for many women. And the U.S. Embassy mentioned that through the cables I received over the past 20 years. That came up again and again, and they were concerned, yet there wasn't much they could do. If the Guatemalan government, recognized a child who had been sold into the system as a legitimate orphan, and that orphan was presented then to the U.S. Embassy as a correctly relinquished child, there was nothing they could do.
Mm. So after this, I take it that given your involvement in this case, is this a subject that you're going to continue to follow as a journalist?
I will continue to follow it. I'm not going to write another book, but I do have a website. It's findingfernanda.com, where I do follow sort of the breaking Guatemalan adoption news. There's a lot of unraveling cases at this time now that the industry is in pause. A lot of these criminal cases and prosecutions on the Guatemalan side of things are picking up traction. They're moving forward. So I do follow that news and report on it.
Erin Siegel is an investigative journalist and photographer. Her new book is called Finding Fernanda, Two Mothers, One Child, and a Cross-Border Search for Truth. Erin, it really is a fascinating piece of work. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you for having me on, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions about the show to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.